Congratulations, you have found the Lambcast, the official podcast of the Large Association of Movie Blogs, also known as the LAMB. The LAMB is the largest collective of online movie blogs and podcasts with 2,000 members and counting. Every week on the Lambcast, various members of the LAMB community get together to talk about our favorite subject, movies. So bookmark the LAMB and follow us on social media. Be sure to join us each week to hear a lively discussion of films and movie-related talk from our members. Join the flock at largeassmovieblogs.com. LAMB alone weak, LAMBs together strong. Welcome, everyone, to the Lambcast. This is episode 729, and I'm your host, Richard Kirkham, from Kirkham A Movie A Day. So what brings us together this week in order to make us strong? The answer is simple, the April Movie of the Month. The April Movie of the Month is a franchise selection promoted by one of our LAMBs. Often this means either a very short inventory of films or a very long list. In trying to compromise and create something that was reasonable, it was suggested that we limit our Planet of the Apes discussion to just the three films that make up the reboot, primarily directed by Matt Reeves, but that turns out that it's not entirely accurate, and the next one, by the way, is also not directed by Matt Reeves, so that's a little bit of a change. However, that means that Charlton Heston will not be making an appearance, at least not as a featured player in today's podcast. It also means that Roddy McDowall will not be trying on a leisure suit or leading a revolution of house pets in any of the films that we talk about today. The star of these movies is clearly Andy Serkis, who plays the ape Caesar in a motion capture performance in all three films, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, War for the Planet of the Apes. All three films were championed by Matt Simpson of the Awesome Friday podcast. He'll be hosting in just a few minutes, but before he takes over, let me introduce the other lambs in the pasture this week. From Mad Lab Post comes Nicole Ayers, who has no intention of allowing a simian virus to infect her online work. Welcome, Nicole.
Thanks for having me, and you're spot on with that, Richard. I'm not here for any monkey business.
Also joining us from the Cabot Cove Confab, Sean Humrick, who, despite not being victorious in this month's franchise poll vote, graciously agreed to join the show and talk about the franchise that was chosen over the one he preferred. Have a cookie, Sean.
Yes. Yes, thank you, everybody. I'm trying to come up with a snappy thing to say, but I have corns on my heels, making it like corn helios. That's all I got.
It's a stretch. It worked. If you have a fever and a cough or a sore throat, stay home. I'd say 95% chance of this is manufactured. It came out of a laboratory. The source of the virus was traced back to a drug test done at Syngen Laboratories in San Francisco. The lab technician, now known as Patient Zero, was accidentally exposed to a retrovirus. If all of this sounds a little familiar, don't blame the Wuhan lab. Blame our host today, Matthew Simpson. Matt, take it away.
Thank you for that introduction. I honestly don't know what to do with it. We are talking about Planet of the Apes, which is a franchise that I think is one of the better modern franchises and one of the better reboot franchises. So just to get us going as a quick reboot, for a recap of the show, of the movies, we have Rise and Dawn and War for the Planet of the Apes. Rise chronicles the very introduction of intelligent apes. War picks up 10 years later after a global calamity and a virus escapes, and a new group of intelligent apes comes into conflict with a remnant group of survivors of humanity. And then the third film takes place 2 years after that, when the conflict has escalated into an all-out war. And what I'd like to start with simply is, and we'll just go around the room and I'll go last, but Richard, why don't you start us off and just tell us what your journey is with these three films? Like, did you see them in cinemas or did you see them after the fact? And what was your expectation going in?
I'll tell you what, I saw the first two films in the cinema. The third one I didn't catch up with until later on when it was streaming. Actually, I think I saw it on a satellite channel looking for it. When they first decided to reboot this, I was a little uncertain. I was not enthusiastic about the Tim Burton remake, obviously, and a lot of people were disappointed that that went nowhere. But I was very pleased with the first one, The Rise of the Planet of the Apes. It was done in a very different style. The motion capture technology seemed to work pretty well for what they were doing at the time. And I thought it laid the groundwork for a lot of development of a, if not entirely connected story, one that would allow us to return to the original franchise as long as we're willing to go through 3,000 years of other stories. I liked the first one very much at the time that it came out. I think it was very appealing. The second one, when I saw it, I enjoyed it. I found it pretty high quality. Maybe it has a couple of things in it that went off in a direction that I wasn't necessarily looking forward to, but I could see how they were still doing the same sort of thing, planting seedlings for the future of the franchise, and I appreciated that. And the third one, I saw it once years ago on probably a satellite channel that I don't remember, and I watched it again this week, and I was surprised how little of it I remembered. I know I'd seen it, and one or two pieces came back in my head, and it felt very different from the film that I was thinking it was, although it does have the climactic battle kind of stuff that you are expecting, and there is a little bit of a surprise ending to the way things go, which I'd forgotten about, and explains what happens in the future and probably sets up this new film that's coming. So I appreciated them all. I admired the first two quite a bit. The third one I'm still kind of adjusting to and trying to figure out how I feel about it. But I was satisfied that this was a good reboot of the concept.
Pretty much with you on most of that. But Nicole, why don't you take it away? What same question. What was your journey with these films?
My journey started with, I believe, Tim Burton's version, although I forgot about it until I started preparing for this podcast and realized that, oh, I did see this movie because I was going to try to binge all of the older ones. But I don't remember much about that movie except for the chimpanzee named Ari, I think. The woman played by Helena Bonham Carter, who is a favorite of mine from the Harry Potter movies, but I didn't know that she was the actress in that film, but I don't remember much about it. So the trilogy is kind of my main source of material when it comes to to the franchise. I am interested in watching the original movies that came out in the 60s and 70s when I have an opportunity to do so. But the first one I saw in the theater, the second one, I think I saw it at my friend Tasha's house. I missed it in the theater. And the third one I streamed. And I loved them. I could watch them all over and over and over. I never get tired of it, and I really appreciate, I think that the Planet of the Apes, between Rupert Wyatt and Matt Reeves, I think they both did a really good job creating this hero's journey and providing some continuity between all of these movies that I hope will continue when Kingdom comes out. I look forward to getting my tail into a theater so that I don't miss this particular one. But I think, similar to in a previous episode, Richard mentioned how he asked his students what makes a good movie, and one young boy said Bruce Willis and guns. I think that
That's such a perfect answer.
Yes, it is. And I think Planet of the Apes has all of the things that I love about action movies and the animal kingdom. I have a soft spot for a lot of movies involving the animal, various aspects of the animal kingdom. although I never got into Godzilla or the King Kong movies, but with Planet of the Apes, I have, you know, revenge, animals getting revenge, explosions, and war. I like a good war movie, so I think they all make they're all a recipe for a good movie in my book. And Planet of the Apes continues to deliver, so I love it, and I'm here for it.
Excellent answer. And Sean, how about you?
I don't have a lot of hit. Well, I do have a lot of history with Planet of the Apes. A long time ago, maybe 25 years ago, when I was home alone, my parents weren't there, and I had enough time. Just think about the time when you had this much time. I watched all, I don't know if it was TC, it was before streaming. I watched all of the Planet of the Apes movies in like 2 days. Okay. And I loved it. I loved the idea that it was a paradox and it was all that. And when Tim Burton came out with this thing, I'm going to emphasize thing. I'm sorry, Nicole. I remember I brought it home from Blockbuster. That's how long ago it was. And the DVD wouldn't work in my player. And I was like, oh, whatever. Then I'm not going to watch it if you're so highfalutin. You're going to put in all these DVD extras that aren't going to be compatible with my player. But after that, I know that's not the main point of this podcast right now, but after that, we did go to see Rise of the Planet of the Apes when it came out. I think it was in 2011. Is that right?
I think that's
2011.
I believe so. Yeah, 2011.
Enjoyed it thoroughly. And then for some reason or another, I don't know, private life, whatever, it was just, I cast it from my mind. I had no interest after that, even though I liked the movie. And so Friday night and this morning I watched Dawn and War. And so I am full-fledged mostly into this whole thing. I mean, it's right off my mind. And I'm prepared to talk about it, and we'll get there.
Excellent. Well, for my part, I watched all of the original ones. This is going to be my next question, but I watched all of the original ones when I was a kid. And when Rise of the Planet of the Apes was announced, I honestly can't remember if I saw it in cinemas or not. I remember not being similar to Richard's reaction. I remember being like, really, we're doing this again? Because I had been sort of burned a little bit by the Tim Burton one. Even though I think in hindsight, there's plenty to love about it. So I wasn't that enthusiastic, and when I saw it, I was like, oh, yeah, this is pretty good. Me and my friend have a joke that you know, the subtitle of that movie should be Shit Here Come the Monkeys, which I think is pretty funny. And so when Dawn rolled around, I was like, well, you know, if nothing else, like, the effects in this movie are incredible, so I want to see this on the biggest screen as I can. So, and I was blown away by Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. In particular, both in terms of the effects, but in the way that Matt Reeves tells the story, shoots the story, and the depth of not only Andy Serkis's performance, but Toby Kebbell's as Koba, which I'm sure we'll get into in a few minutes. And then that when War came around, I was like, all right, this is clearly one of the better modern like franchise reboots. I'm definitely seeing this opening day. And I was not disappointed. It's also a great film, and I think my favorite thing about them, and we all sort of answered. My next question was going to be like, had you seen the originals? I think we've all basically answered that at this point. But I think what I like about it in terms of the story is similar to what Richard was saying, is that it's very easy to see how. Because there's a 2,000-year gap before Planet of the Apes, it's very easy to see how they could basically tell any story they wanted as long as they hit a few key points. And then those key points would sort of fall into myth over 2,000 years and become the things they talked about in Planet of the Apes. And I feel like the films did a really good job of that, of hitting the key points whilst not being constrained by, quote, the lore. You know, the kind of thing you see in other franchises where, you know, angry online nerds will argue about how, like, this didn't line up with that. This film has had the freedom to sort of tell its own story and is better for it. Even whilst still respecting the, quote, lore and playing into the things we need to see for the originals. Even though, as I'm sure some of you are aware, the last two original films are basically a remake of those last two films. Anyway. So for those of us, and I think it might be just me and Richard, but Richard, why don't you tell us, like, do you feel the same way? Do you feel like they play into one another, like the new ones and the old ones? Do you feel like that mythology connects well?
Yeah, I think it connects pretty well. They set up the right ideas on it. I don't want to be one of those online nerds who is screaming about, hey, you missed something here. But there is an important difference between the long-term scenario storylines in the original Planet of the Apes series. Human beings destroy themselves in a nuclear war. Here it appears that we have eliminated ourselves through a genetic manipulation of technology and created this virus that enhances the apes and destroys the humans. So that difference aside, everything else seems to be nicely set up for, you know, how the humans culture crashes and how the ape culture rises. Mm-hmm. But they also aren't nearly as different from one another as either Taylor would have expected 2,500 years ago or 2,500 years in the future, or as Caesar, I think, ultimately comes to recognize that the apes and humans have more in common than they really want to admit. So I, like you said, I think that makes it possible to tell all kinds of stories between now and when they are supposedly going to ultimately end up in the same situation that they were in. You know, that would make it a big time loop story, and then somebody can put it together in their minute-by-minute podcast and cover all 700 films.
It's interesting, too, because I actually feel like, you know, in the originals, it's this devastating nuclear war that's happened. And I feel like you can still kind of hand wave that away as having happened in just the title sequence for Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, which just is a spinning globe with the, like, population of the world sort of ballooning and then shrinking as the virus spreads. And there's, like, news voiceovers about a terrible war that's happening. And I feel like you can basically be like, well, the war did happen. Just no bombs dropped on San Francisco is sort of my headcanon, at least. I don't know. Does anyone have any opinions about that? Nicole, why don't we start with you on that?
Yeah, okay. So that's what I was, because I was trying to visualize what you guys were discussing as it relates to those original films. And because I haven't seen them, I'm not sure if it would be, I guess, appropriate for me to have, like, an opinion with regards to the lore. I do want to view them so that I can kind of do, like, compare and contrast, like, between the two. From what I've read about the original films, it seems like the first five, if there were five, appear to be more about, like, space travel and the evolution of a species, while this later trilogy reboot and the fourth one that's coming out appears to tap into that genetic modification that Richard mentioned. And also, for me, the consequences of what happens when you screw with nature. I think that humans are always meddling in things that they shouldn't be. And then when you have to face the repercussions of that, all of a sudden, the habitat or the species, or the, in this case, the animals that you're toying with, you know, come after you. And now you want to kill them all to save the humans. And so I feel like this new trilogy, I think that it has a lot of elements that are like relevant and like people can kind of relate to, given the things that are going on like in society in terms of like habitat loss and things like that. I'm not like a huge tree hugger per se, but I think that we're encroaching on, you know, animals' territory and people's territory. And, you know, the more we do that, you know, then the more we're going to create a situation where, you know, you keep poking a bear, eventually that bear is, you know, going to come after you. So that's what I think. That's my take from the Planet of the Apes, the later films, the trilogy.
Well, you're certainly not wrong. And Sean, again, any strong opinions here?
Oh yeah. Okay, I can't really speak to Rise because I saw that so long ago. But it's so, I can talk about War for a long time. War of the Planet of the Apes. I watched what's the second, Dawn, a couple days ago, and I was kind of milkwarm about it. And then when I watched War, I was like, wow, there's a lot more to it. And Nicole kind of touched on it, that it is kind of topical. They didn't mean that at the time when they did it. And now this new one that's going to come out in a couple weeks, is that going to be more topical? And when I say topical, I'm going to come out and say it's the Middle East. It's the Palestine-Israel thing. I don't care what side you're on. I'm kind of not on either side. But it really reminded me of that. And also, the third one, War of the Planet of the Apes, it was a little bit, reminded me, there was the touch of racism, which I don't think was touched on in Dawn. I don't think certainly it was touched on in Rise, although I may be wrong. But, you know, things like he's not like us. We have the little girl that was rescued by Maurice, and she becomes what she think she, at one point she asks, am I an ape? I think it's a really, really good film, War. And the problem is that I have to watch the first, I'm sorry, maybe the second film before I understand what the third film was about. I don't know if that's a good thing for the film or not, or if it just works with marketing, or maybe they just made it both films at the same time, made like a 3-hour film, but yeah, it's there.
I mean, if they made both films at the same time, that's a 4.5-hour film, and I think it would be perfectly fine to watch it that way. That's basically what, for the record, that's basically what I did. I rewatched. So when I suggested to Richard that this would be my choice for the franchise movie of the month, I rewatched Rise pretty much right away. That was back in like February. And then I watched Dawn of and War for 2 nights ago and last night, respectively. So they're pretty fresh in my mind as well. And so first of all, I think you're spot on in terms of like how they relate to the current world. And I think that they are, I think the beauty of science fiction like this is that you can take whatever story they're trying to tell and you can relate it to either a current or a near past situation, right? So I don't think it's intentionally Israel and Palestine, but like, yeah, it's Israel and Palestine. Like, it's whatever oppressor and oppressed situation you want to put it onto, right? And I think that I personally, it sounds like you liked War 4 the better of the three, and I liked Dawn the best of the three, for the record.
You're correct. Yeah, I liked War more. Yeah.
And I think that you're also spot on in terms of, like, you can definitely put, like, racism as a theme on here, right? Like, you know, they're just animals. They're not like us. They are, they're different. They're scary. They're, you know, their society is primitive. There's so much in terms of, like, racism and colonialism that you could just put on this franchise.
Now, that being said, there were some things that there was one thing in particular that stuck out with me that I had a problem with that the apes did. And the little girl that Maurice adopts, what's her name? I can't remember. They do give
Nova.
Her
Nova.
Nova, which was a car. Yes, by the way, my grandma drove that car back in the day. But when they kill, I think it's Caesar, when he kills her dad, or what would be her dad, when he says, hey, I'm just going to drop this here. What he's saying is, I'm going to drop this here and then we'll talk. And is it Caesar that shoots him?
So in that scene, the man they encounter at the little homestead, he's carrying some firewood, and they obviously have a moment where they're having a standoff, like a stare down. And the guy says, I'm just going to put this down. And he goes to drop the firewood, and as he drops the firewood, he also pulls out a gun from behind his back.
I did not see that.
I missed that. Damn. Yeah. I need to rewatch this now, because I thought that Caesar just shot him as he's putting that firewood down, and I'm like, well, geez, okay, he's really serious.
There's a big difference.
I missed that.
Yeah, the guy definitely has a gun. He gets like one shot off, but it's like off to the side because Caesar doesn't. You are right though. Caesar does not wait. Like, as soon as the guy makes any motion that is not just putting the wood down, Caesar has just shot him. But he does have a gun. So, and I think it's still an effective scene because it's in terms of that film, Caesar has already suffered a pretty monumental loss. The humans have attacked the apes at this point and killed his wife and son. Sorry for spoilers for a 10-year-old film.
You passed the statute of limitations for spoilers, sir.
Yeah.
Those of you listening to this show should know this is not going to be one of those where we keep you in suspense about what happens.
No. But what I was going to say is that, like, I think it's still a very effective scene in War because it shows that Caesar, who in the previous two films has been shown to be, like, far more trusting of humans than any of the other apes, because he's one of the only apes that has ever had positive experiences with humans, as in he did in Rise with his father figure. But he's lost all that at this point. And he, you know, in the previous film, it would have been him in the stare down and somebody else killing the humans. And I think that's a pretty important swap out to show Caesar's sort of progression in this film. Because War 4 is by far the most, I would say, the most personal of the stories for Caesar himself. I don't know. Would anyone have any strong thoughts about, I guess we can get into the overall themes here about Caesar and his journey with the humans. But, like, let's go back to Richard. Do you have any strong feelings about this? What do you think of Caesar's journey of, like, childlike figure to leader to, like, you know, jaded, revenge-seeking person?
Well, I think you just described the whole story arc of his character. He is an innocent who he's not betrayed so much by his family, but, you know, he is certainly mistreated by the culture that he is in. And then he turns to more independence. There's a similar moment to the one you're describing when he, in the first film, in Rise, where he turns down the chance to go back with the James Franco character and return to what he previously would have called his home, because he makes a statement of independence from that world, and he's basically returning to his species as opposed to his upbringing. And I think you get a little bit, like you said, in this sequence in War, where he confronts the the equivalent of a deserter who's deserted to protect the girl. I assume it's his daughter who has the retrovirus that's creating these problems for the humans. Like you said, Caesar basically is less patient, less tolerant, and takes another turn here. A similar kind of dramatic moment where it's not, in this case, about who he identifies with, but how he's going to act and behave.
Right. And where does he take the turn? Wait, I'm sorry, Richard. Where does he take the turn?
In war, you know, obviously after his family has been eliminated, he I don't want to say he becomes a cold-hearted killer, but he certainly becomes less patient and less willing to listen to any human, whereas in the past he was very patient with those. So that's the one turn. But the turn in the first film in Rise, which, Sean, it sounds like you haven't seen for a while. He is basically been quarantined. He was
sequestered from
what's the phrase? He was impounded after an attack on the neighbor. And James Franco's character is, you know, gets to him at one point and tries to get him to come back to him. This is after they've had a big incident in the impound where all the apes are. And, you know, Caesar basically says no. He's, you know, when we're talking about the no, the famous no, you know, an ape said no. I'm sorry, that's, you know, which of the originals was that in?
It's in the first one where Cornelius is describing ape history to Charlton Heston's character, which name escapes me at the moment. I'm Taylor. I think that there's two, like the big no sequence in Rise is what you're describing, right? Not the no sequence, but like right after that, Will, James Franco comes in and is like, I want to take you home. And Caesar's like, no, like, I can't leave these apes here to suffer. Which is why him leaving all the apes to suffer in war becomes a bit powerful, because throughout the first two films, he's like, no, I'm the leader. I'm responsible. Like, I have to be here for my people. And then in war, he goes on a revenge spree and he's forced back into that role in the second and third acts. And I think that's really powerful personally.
I agree. I think that Caesar is a really good standard for leaders. Like, okay, I'm going to make bad decisions. Some people will be sacrificed. And I'm going to admit, though, that in Dawn, I was on the side of Koba for a while there.
Yes.
So that was actually going to be my next question, but before we get there, I think we've heard from everyone except for I don't think we've heard from Nicole on this particular topic. If you have any strong feelings, voice them now, and then we'll move on to the whole Koba situation, because I think it's one of the strongest situations in the trilogy, personally.
I do have strong feelings about different things. I favor the whole trilogy. I am a fan of both Dawn and War equally, because it just seemed like each film built on the previous one when it came out.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, from Rise to Dawn to War, and now came, like, they're just knocking it out. So keep it going. And I hope they do a good job with Kingdom. But for me, the opening scene in War is brutal. And I think that they did a great job building tension. And the scene in the shack after Caesar kills the dad, that scene where they're looking for supplies almost gave me an anxiety attack. Then there's another time when Caesar was trying to seize an opportunity to grab the colonel's gun, and I started to look away because I was nervous about what's about to happen next. Will he get the gun, or will the colonel shoot him? And it'll be all over. So It was I enjoyed the tension in War, but I think from that brutal opening scene when Caesar sends the captured soldiers off as a message to through to the end of the movie, I enjoyed the character, like the story and the character arc there, but he had a rude awakening. We saw the Caesar that we usually see in the beginning of War, but then, you know, as you know, we've discussed here, like he kind of turned. I do think that Caesar has great, I do think he's a great leader. I think that some of the sacrifices that were made in him coming into the type of leader that has to make really hard decisions, I think some of those sacrifices were unnecessary, because if Koba was still alive, some of the other hardships that Caesar and the apes faced may not have happened. Caesar's family might still be alive had he listened to Koba. But as we'll talk about soon, I'm sure, you know, when Matthew gets around to it, I think Koba made some missteps himself.
Yeah, when he shot Caesar.
Yeah. And so, but I think that War, I was crying during the scene in War where the little girl gives her flower to the gorilla Luca. And I think that, I don't know if that was all about the movie or if it was about like my own kind of internal like stuff that I was dealing with before I saw the movie, which leads me to like a quote that Koba once said. He mentioned that scars make you strong, and I understand his perspective, but that's just, I think that's just the scars that we can see. I think it's the internal scars that we can't see that are a real bitch. And the colonel, his scars made him into a cruel, like, alcoholic. But I think that the ape from the zoo in War is hilarious.
Yes,
that ape is hilarious.
What's the name? I don't even know what the name is.
Bad Ape. His name is Bad Ape.
Yeah, Bad Ape. Bad Ape. Okay. He is a hilarious character. I love him.
He's done so well. He could be the Jar Jar Binks of Planet of the Apes, but he's not. He does it really well. Like, oh, I'm from a zoo. I'm from a, but there's a people zoo.
Yeah.
Richard, what do you think about all this?
Well, I think that, like we've been talking about, the character of Caesar has human qualities. You know, he's capable of making mistakes. He's capable of forgiveness, but when he is personally injured in the dramatic way that he is in War, we're faced with, is he going to become the colonel? And it's ultimately, he returns to the notion that he has to protect his tribe, his group, the apes that have been captured, you know, and turn away a little bit from this notion that he has to get revenge. That sort of restores him to the position of respect that I think he had developed through the first two films, especially. And you know, we get a good story about a character that has to go through the same kinds of challenges that any person would go through, only it's not a person in the traditional sense. It's, you know, a different species and certainly with different experiences. But the idea is, you know, everybody is faced with these kinds of challenges. And the question is, you know, what kind of leader you are, what kind of person you are, depends on how you respond to them. And that's the point that I see in the story. You know, the bigger picture about, you know, what's going to happen to the world, that matters as well. But this has been The first three films, pardon me, the first three films were Caesar's story. And, you know, we get, when we get to the end of that, we're going to be moving on. The COPA issue is, sounds like what Matt wanted to talk about next. So I don't want to step all over that. But I do think that, you know, COPA also represents a contrasting position about how, you know, apes and humans are more alike than they are different.
Yeah, I think that's all pretty on point. I just want to talk for a moment, just to come back to something Nicole was mentioning, this scene where Nova, like, you know, gives the flower back to the dying Luca. And I think that the inclusion of Nova is really integral to the success of the third film. Partially because it's a nice callback to the originals. You know, there's always a character, a human called Nova. But also because, like, especially in that first and into the second act, like, when Caesar has lost empathy, like, this little girl, like, what better way to reintroduce it than to introduce an innocent? And he's ready to charge in and kill all the humans, and she's, even though they just killed her father in front of her, she's finding empathy for the dying gorilla. And I felt that whole sequence was really powerful. And I didn't cry at that one, but I do get a little teary at the moment you guys mentioned earlier, which is when she asks Maurice if she's an ape, and they do the little, like, ape together strong sign. But yeah, let's move into some of the performances, and in particular, let's talk about COPA, and then we'll talk about some of the performances. So COPA becomes sort of the overreaching villain of the franchise, starting as a lab ape in the first one, and then the antagonist of the second one, and then a antagonizing hallucination in the third one. I think that Toby Kebbell, who plays COPA in the second and third one, is putting in some career best work in this movie, in these movies. And I'm curious to see how you guys feel about this antagonist character, about someone who is effectively the other side of the coin that Caesar is one side of. And Richard, you sounded like you had something to say about it, so let's start with you.
Yeah, I think COPA's a character that is hard for him to be redeemed. I know that there's this, and Nicole has suggested, and Sean has suggested a little bit, that COPA's position, if they'd followed through, would have been maybe a saving situation for the whole ape tribe. But that assumes that, you know, that's sort of the same sort of thing that you might say about any, you know, human military interaction. Well, if we just, you know, bomb the shit out of them, we'd have solved the problem before it, you know, became a bigger problem. And I think that that's, you know, again, we're back to the same sorts of dilemmas that we're faced with here. I think COPA, you know, he has great loyalty at the beginning of that second film. The first act is about his willingness to kind of defer his own fury and anger because Caesar has, you know, tried to be accommodating, and because Caesar's called for it. But there's a point at which he switches, and if you're going to give these characters, you know, credit for the motion capture performances, then I think that that's an important part of the film, when COPA, in essence, you know, changes sides, so to speak. He's certainly not changing to the side of the humans, but he is changing an oppositional position to Caesar, and you can see kind of in his head how he's, and, you know, he's a planner. He's got a strategy. He's figured out how to frame the humans for what happens, create antagonism on the humans' part toward the apes, and get the war that he wants. He's, you know, the more successful Vincini.
I think everything you're saying is correct. I'm going to just preemptively say I disagree with the idea that if COPA was still alive, they'd be winning. Because I think that if COPA had survived through to the end of Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, I think all the apes would be dead. Because it's very clear, maybe not all dead, but I think it's very clear that COPA is, and it's actually a theme of the film, that, like, COPA is Caesar's opposite. He's not fighting for apes, he's fighting for COPA. He's not fighting for betterment of his people, he's fighting to get revenge on humans. And I feel like he's willing to throw as many apes into the fight to get that as are available to him. Like, he's not a responsible leader, and responsible leaders don't lead to success. So
I think that's absolutely true. I didn't mean to suggest that was the strategy. I just think that, you know, Kova is...
Just to be clear, I wasn't actually disagreeing with you. I was disagreeing with the idea that, like, they would be in a stronger position in the third film if he had made it out of the second one or something. I can't remember. Sean or Uncle, one of you said that. I can't remember who it was. But.
Yeah, I said that, and I agree and disagree with you, Matthew, at the same time. Like, I do think that Caesar, you know, is a strong leader just in general. Not thinking about any of the characters, anytime I think of Planet of the Apes, like the franchise, when I think of Planet of the Apes, I think of Caesar. And I'm like, long live Caesar. At the same time, I do think that there is a place for both Caesar and Koba. And I think that given Koba's struggles and anger, I think that eventually maybe in his personality, we probably would have, you know, come to a situation where there is a battle and some apes will end up dead because, you know, someone's going to have to kill Koba or Cobra's going to get killed by humans or something's going to happen. But he probably wouldn't have lived long. That said, I do think that there is a place for Koba and that he's very necessary to fill in the gaps that Caesar is too blind to fill in Caesar's blind spots.
Because it seems like Caesar,
only when he is, as someone else on here mentioned earlier, only when he's personally affected by the destruction brought on by the humans, only then can he see the humans as, you know, people who are not your friend. Like, they're not here to help you. They're not here to live in harmony with you.
Yeah.
They are here to bring you harm. And so I think Caesar needs that. We need that yin and yang, even if only for a short period of time. I think that there is, I think it would have been good for Koba to stick around for a long time, even if only just to serve the purpose of keeping, you know, a lot of apes alive, Caesar included, because Caesar got captured and everything. All of that could have been mitigated had we not killed Koba. And I think the misstep, yes, he did shoot Caesar. For me, though, the unfortunate misstep that Koba made was betraying the group by lying through lies and manipulation rather than convincing them why, you know, humans can't be trusted and why, you know, they would all be safer if they stuck together as a unit and stayed as far away from the humans as possible. And I love that we're talking about apes, I will say.
I know Sean has something that he wants to say. I want him to be able to say it, but I've got something I want to add too here in a second.
I was going to say that I absolutely agree with Nicole and Don when he says we can't trust them, we're human, and everybody's like, whatever. No, seriously, guys, you can't trust them. You can't trust them. They eventually do have that pocket of humans that comes and, you know, helps them, but mostly you can't fucking trust these people. You know, it's how it is.
We were looking for comparisons to human behavior. Koba is basically the Nazis burning down the Reichstag when he burns down his own village in order to provoke a war with the humans. And my speculation is, I haven't read anything about it, so I don't know, but it looks to me like this new version of the film is the, you know, what happens if Koba was the leader of the ape community.
It's certainly, I'll come back to that in a second. But I just wanted to chime in and say that I don't think that what you guys are talking about is incorrect. I think that Koba existing in a very, like, and this is maybe a nerdier reference than I should be making, but in a very, like, Professor X and Magneto way, they kind of need each other, right? Like, where Caesar is very trusting of humans and very much like, if we just show them that we're good, they will respect us. And Koba's like, they're never going to respect us. That is an important theme, and it carries through into war when Caesar's having hallucinations of Koba, and people are being like, you know, you're acting about like Koba did, right? Especially in that first act. All I'm disagreeing about is that, like not that Caesar doesn't need that, because he clearly needs that, but that if Koba is the leader of the apes at the end of Dawn and the beginning of war, then there are a lot fewer alive apes than there are in war, is all I'm trying to say. Because he's far more destructive and selfish of a leader than Caesar ever would be. And I said it was going to come back to something, and my train of thought just derailed. So I think it was Richard. Why don't you elaborate on what you're talking about a little bit?
I'm trying to remember what it was that you were going to talk about also, because it seemed like it was something that I was ready to go for. Oh, I think you were going to talk eventually about the performances of the characters in the film. And, you know, that's mostly motion capture, although we do have human characters in the film as well. The motion capture performances are impressive. Obviously, Andy Serkis is the one who gets the most credit, because mm-hmm. Caesar is the character that we follow the closest. And the other performers, particularly Koba and Maurice and some of the other characters that get names that are repeated, they have their moments, and I think that that's effective. There are a lot of characters in these films that are performed by actors who have names and resumes, and I don't think they get much to do, and it's not particularly distinctive. The only characters that I think stand out when it comes to the motion capture performances are the main ones that we've just been talking about.
Yeah, I just remember what we're going to talk about. You mentioned that the upcoming film seems like it might be about,
oh yeah,
what would if a Koba-esque character takes over, and I think that is pretty accurate in a way where I think it, and again, I haven't read anything about this either, but in a way that might relate to the current United States political landscape, and Canadian for that matter, it does look like, what if a strongman cult of personality took over, you know? But anyway, yeah, let's move on. The performances, Richard, I'm going to disagree, though. All the performances, I think, are great. And I think that Maurice, in particular, stands out. I think that Andy Serkis as Caesar is great. I think that Toby Kebbell as Koba is amazing. And I think that Karen Conneval as Maurice stands out. And you're right that they don't have a ton to necessarily do, like, scene to scene or through the movie, but every scene that requires, like, a voice of moderation, like, or any level of empathy, Maurice is a character that brings that. And I think it's not the biggest role, but I think that it is one of the more important roles in the franchise, and especially in the third one, where Maurice is a character that adopts Nova and is constantly trying to remind Caesar of the person and the leader he is. Not that he's meant to be, but that he actually is, that he needs to get back to being. Did anyone else, any of the other eight performances, stand out to anyone? And Richard, I think you've talked about this a little bit, so let's start with Sean.
I'm going to say, but you mentioned Maurice. I think that Maurice may be named after Maurice Evans, who played Dr. Zaius in the original Planet of the Apes. But I love the character. The thing that he did with the little girl was excellent. As far as characters go, I'm going to say something bad. The second one, Dawn. Those humans, Yeah, and I didn't care for any of them. Like, there were like four or five of them in like a Jeep. They came across them. Oh, they're fighting us. Oh, we have to go back and talk. And there was Gary Oldman there for, you know, a hot second, and he got blew up. I don't know why, but does it answer your question? I don't know. Go on to the next person.
Nicole, let's go on to you. And how did you feel about performances, and did anyone stand out to you?
I loved all of the performances. Like the rest of you all, I do think that the actor that played Maurice did well, and Maurice as an ape, just in general, I think that he was a good advisor to Caesar. And I'm hoping that I can get my mom to eventually watch these movies, because she refuses to watch. I'm trying to get her to go see Kingdom, and she won't. And my mom remembers the TV show, which I am not, I don't know anything about it. And I wasn't even around when the original movies came out. But when I told her about Kingdom coming out, she was like, apes that talk like people, no thanks. So I love that we're discussing it. And my favorite character among them all, besides the main ones, are still the Bad Ape from War, because Bad Ape is funny and has great fashion sense. And I think Bad Ape is, for me, like a reflection of the West, in that, like, he didn't know how to use, there's a scene where he doesn't know how, he has the binoculars like backwards, and he's like, oh, it's so small. And I think Maurice turns the binoculars around. He's like, oh. And in that, in a couple of other scenes, made me think, look at Bad Ape the way that I imagine other cultures look at us in the West, in the sense that, like, Bad Ape, for all of his resources, and he can talk like humans. And yes, the apes, who have their own language, seem to be a little more intelligent than him when it comes to certain aspects of survival. So living in the zoo, he adapted the way of humans. And now he's out in the woods or what have you, like, he doesn't really know how to function properly, and he doesn't want to do things. Like, he doesn't want to climb, when they dug that hole in War, I think, to help Caesar and the kids, like, escape or what have you. He's like, yeah, so the hole's ready to go, and Maurice bends over so that Bad Ape can jump on him and, like, get through the hole. And he's like, It just doesn't register in his mind. And then when it does, he doesn't want to do it. He's just like, oh, no. He's a favorite to me, but also he makes me think, oh, you know, such a stupid American. In terms of, like, Western culture and the comforts. Like, he's the one with the, you know, they want to go find, well, Caesar wants to go find Woody Harrelson. Right. And yet Bad Ape is like, you know, like, no, look, it's snowing outside. Stay, eat, you know, relax. Yeah. And, you know, he just wants to chill and be safe, even to the point where he gives one of his belongings to Nova after telling her a few minutes earlier, no, don't touch, like, don't touch it, don't touch my stuff. But now she can have it so long as we don't go out in the cold and whatnot. Woody Harrelson, I think, did a good job as the colonel. I think that character had a tortured soul in some form. But in the words of Michael Rapaport from the movie Men of Honor, I guess that fucker got his in the end, so it all worked out. Oh, it all worked out.
Yeah, I also love Bad Ape, and I think they directly say this in the movie, that, like, he's an important character, not only because he brings a much-needed levity to the film, but he also hints at a much larger world, because he's evolved and learned to speak separately from our main group of apes, and it hints that, like, the world is much larger and there's much more going on than just this one story. But Richard, let's move on to finish up with you. How did you feel about these performances, and who stood out for you?
Well, in the human performances, I think that in the first film, I thought I like John Lithgow, who is kind of the motivation for everything, because Franco's character is trying to find a solution to Alzheimer's, and he's losing his father to dementia, and that's one of the things that motivates him to create this genetically manipulated formula that's going to enhance people's ability. You know, it's basically, we've talked about it before, it's Frankenstein, it's Deep Blue Sea. So if you guys want a connection there, Jay, listen to that. You know, now Planet of the Apes, Rise of the Planet of the Apes should be counted in the Deep Blue Sea pantheon, and we should be covering that on your podcast, damn it.
But you long enough to say I agree.
But it's you know, and so I liked him in the second film. I like, you know, I don't know about the performance so much, but I like the fact that Gary Oldman's character is not necessarily a villain. He's just struggling like everybody else to make sense of what to do, and he makes the same kind of bad choices that everybody is making in the film. In most films, he would be the traditional villain, you know, and sending out, you know, a warlike attitude about things. And instead, the humans and the apes come in conflict as a combination of Koba's plot and accidents. And I like that a lot. And the Colonel, the Woody Harrelson character in the end, I think Nicole said it. He's a very tortured and conflicted character who has suffered greatly. And I like the fact that he recognized at the end of the movie, and his soldiers are looking for him. Where is he when they need him, when the battle starts? And he's suffered the very thing that he is so terrified of. You know, he has fallen victim to the retrovirus, and he's lost the ability to speak, which he thinks is the thing that, you know, is the key difference, you know, has been the key difference between the species. And he sees that this is a, you know, a turning point, and, you know, his story arc goes in a different direction at that point. The ape performances, we've already said, Koba and Caesar. And I like Maurice also, although it's funny because Maurice's performance so much is physical in nature. Not, you know, Maurice is the least talkative of the ape characters. I think I would be hard pressed to say if that character had more than 5 or 6 lines in all 3 movies. It's mostly the sign language that is being used there. So it's a little hard to evaluate the performance, although I do think, you know, like I said, as a character, the character works very well. So that's kind of how I feel about the performances.
I think you're not wrong about Maurice being mostly silent, but I would also put forward that, like, there's a moment in Dawn where Koba is effectively taking over leadership of the ape tribe and talking about how they need to go and fight the humans. And there's 3 humans in the camp, and they're standing next to Maurice, and Maurice just goes, run.
Maybe the most effective one-word per, you know, moment in that film, yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's so effective because he so infrequently speaks. It's that, like, this is important enough for me to actually vocalize that you need to understand and you need to get the hell out of here.
Yeah.
I think it's a very powerful and important moment.
He also taught Nova how to say thirsty, which ended up keeping Caesar alive in war, so that worked. So maybe...
Yeah, I mean, Maurice is the teacher of the group, right? Important. Like, Maurice's first scene in Dawn is him teaching all the ape children how to read and write. So it's he's definitely the empathetic one, and the teacher of the group, which I really appreciate. And I'm just going to circle back really quickly to talk about Toby Kebbell again. There's one scene in particular that I think is his strongest, and that is in the second film when he and Caesar are having a disagreement in public, and Caesar's like, we just need to let them do their human work on this dam, and then they'll leave, and Koba starts pointing at his scars and saying, human work, human work. And I thought that was a really powerful and well-performed scene, personally. I'm going to break up the flow just a slight amount here and just point out that these films were filmed in Canada, and as the main Canadian on this podcast, did you know that these films are absolutely chock full of Canadian people? So in the first film, David Hewlett, who is the next door neighbor, is Canadian. Ty Olesen, who is James Franco's like lab partner and ape wrangler, is Canadian. Not Ty Olesen, Tyler Labine, sorry. Roger Cross is in the third one. He's a great respected Canadian actor. And so is Ty Olesen is in the third one. He plays Red, the giant red gorilla, who's initially, for most of the film, he's the donkey gorilla. And I know that's a thing that happens when you film your films in Canada, but like, there's a ton of Canadian people in these films, and I just felt like that was worth pointing out. What's that, sorry?
I said, that is awesome.
Yeah. There's a lot of great Canadian performers, and I feel like another great one is actually in the third film, Lake, the love interest of Caesar's son and the caretaker for his other son, is played by an actress called Sarah Canning. She's a great Canadian actor as well.
If only they'd gotten William Shatner in there, that would have been perfect.
10 out of 10, no notes. I would watch it in a heartbeat. I would love to see William Shatner working through some ape dialogue, but maybe it was the only one. The last main thing I'd like to talk about is these films are obviously successful because they're well-written and well-performed, but they're also, I think, exceedingly well-directed, especially Dawn and War. I'm going to say that I think that the, you know, film is a visual medium, and I think that Matt Reeves has a very good eye for visual storytelling. And I wanted to ask, and we'll start with Nicole this time. Did you have any favorite moments in terms of like the way the films are shot, directed, any of the choices that are made, and any other strong feelings about the way these films, the stories are told?
I liked a lot of the facial expressions between Caesar. Like, I liked the shots between Caesar and that soldier that he spared that ended up in the cavalry, like, later. I don't know that soldier's name, but this was in War, I think. And
you talk about the soldier who gets spared at the beginning and then let go?
Yes, him.
That is Gabriel I'm thinking, I think you're talking about...
He? Like Preacher?
I think you're talking about Preacher from the third
movie. Okay, Preacher, yeah. Him and Preacher, like I like those shots, and I think maybe it was because they made me hope that Preacher would kind of change his tune, and although he never did, for some odd reason it seemed like there's this stare down for a few seconds, and I thought maybe something was going to happen, but it didn't. But I also I'm more of a fan of the score. I liked that it created moments of like planning or strategy, or like and then when the tune changes, then something's about to go down. But in terms of visually, I'm trying to think. There was a scene where they came in to free the kids, the children in War, and I don't know if it was the shot or the overall scene in the performance, but it's one of my pet peeves in most of the movies, usually horror movies, but action and sci-fi tend to have this element as well, but there was like this moment where Caesar hugs his son, Cornelius or what have you, and like, you know, I love you, I'm here, and blah, blah, blah. In that moment, I liked the setup and the shot and the framing and everything, but I thought that they were going to die. And I can't stand when people take like a second to like create like, oh, we don't, you know, I'm so glad to see you or what have you. It's like, we don't have time for these tender moments right now. Like, you have to move. Like, you have to go. You have to go. So I say that all to say that I guess the overall scenes for me, I favor overall scenes rather than specific visuals. The ones that created the most anxiety for me and the nervousness were like when I wanted to look away because I was afraid of like what would happen next. And that was the third act when he wanted to grab the colonel's gun. And then I thought that they were going to show the shot, like when he left the gun, like with the colonel. I thought they were going to show that, and they didn't, and you didn't even hear it. It just went on to the next scene. So I thought that was an interesting move on their part to do that. The avalanche scenes were pretty nice.
Mm-hmm.
To see with the snow and whatnot. That's about it for the visuals for me.
Well, Nicole mentioned right at the very end about the avalanche. I thought that was very effectively presented. You know, it was a nice quick moment of surprise. You know, here's victory, and suddenly it is snatched away from you by a force of nature that basically decides the outcome of the future of the world, because as it was said, you know, how many are coming? All of them. That's pretty much it. That's what was left of humanity, and it's being taken care of there. At least as far as we know in that part of the world. I like that. In the first film, I really like the way the apes moved through the trees up above the streets, and people were aware of them because of the leaves falling down onto the street. And I thought that that was very effective. And when they looked up and they saw the apes moving through the trees, you know, it could have been a Tarzan kind of moment, but instead it was more chilling and interesting as we're watching it. In the second film, there's an early shot of that's right on Caesar's face where they hold the image for a long time, and Caesar looks like he's got war paint on, and you know, it kind of sets the tone for the film in that. And I thought that was pretty good. And when you were talking about Matt Reeves being kind of, you know, somebody who's visually good at creating action or interest in that, it's probably maybe a little over the top, but Kovo with the two machine guns on the horse.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one of those things that jumps out at you and says, okay, this is a sequence that I'm not sure I should like, but I like it anyway.
Yeah, I think that goes a long way to Koba's character too, in that he's really fully committed to just killing as many humans as he possibly can, getting as much revenge as he possibly can.
Yeah.
For me, it's actually, I can think there's one shot in particular that has stuck with me since I first saw it, and that is during the same sequence, actually, when the apes are attacking the humans in San Francisco in the second film. There's a shot where they manage to get control of a tank as it's rolling down the street, and the camera is fixed-mounted to the turret on top of the tank, and the turret is spinning. And so as this tank is rolling down the street and the camera is turning, you get to see this like 360 view of the battle. And I've always thought that was one of, like, if I had to like list memorable shots from the 2010, that would be near the top of the list for me. It's such a interesting shot. It's such an interesting way to show the battle. And to show just the destruction that's happening on all sides during the battle. I've always thought that was one of the most brilliant shots, certainly in this franchise, but like in that decade for sure.
That's a great moment.
Yeah, and I think also like the second film is bookended by those shots of close-ups on Caesar's eyes, and I think that it's an interesting way to bookend the movie, just because it's a matched shot, but also I think it goes a long way to show, you know, the way that the depth of the performance is also in that shot, because we're talking about a close-up on a character's eyes, and the difference in those eyes from the beginning of the film to the end is stark and noticeable, and that takes a lot from a performer to really convey that in such a close-up shot, and I really, really like that, and I feel like you can't achieve that without just spectacular direction. So, yeah, that was all I really had to talk about. I don't know if we have Sean back or not. But
can I add something?
Yeah, I was going to ask, does anyone have anything that we haven't touched on that we'd like to touch on? And Nicole, sounds like you have something, so let's go there.
I just wanted to mention, like Richard, when Richard mentioned Tarzan and the leaves, it reminded me of a scene that I did like in War, and I'm not sure if it was so much as the shot. It was a good shot, but I just like to see. I liked when they were when they finally freed the children apes. I liked the scene where they were like all climbing or moving from like one area to the next. They were climbing over this wire that was like above the soldiers. I can see it in my head, but it's hard to describe right now. But I really liked that scene, to see all those the kids just moving along like smoothly along the wire. Although I was afraid that the soldiers would like notice them, but I thought that was a favorite scene of mine to see. And I forgot all about it until Richard mentioned Tarzan.
Well, the Tarzan thing is also nice. There's a nice callback to it in the second film when Kirk Acevedo, I think his name is sitting in a truck, and then a bunch of leaves start falling around the truck. It was a nice callback to the first film. Richard, did you have anything? Is there anything we haven't touched on that you would like to touch on?
All right, well, my main criticism of the films is something that I'm not sure I know how they could get around, and it's just inevitable that it's going to happen. And it's the awkwardness of the dialogue. It so frequently sounds like the "me Tarzan, you Jane," the Indians talking to the cowboys in the old westerns. It's the truncated use of language. But they are learning the language and how to speak it. And I don't know how you get around that without it sounding so corny and hokey. And that's, you know, you can get away with it with Bad Ape a little bit because it's a comic character and we're having some of that. But it often feels to me like there's something here. Maybe we should have used more of the sign language and less of the, kind of simplified English language, you know, that sounds so old-fashioned hokey. Like I said, I have no idea how you get around it. It was just one of those things that I noticed whenever I was watching the films. I thought I had just moments of discomfort kind of listening to it going, this just doesn't seem right to me. But I can't explain how you would get around that given the way the story is supposed to be playing.
I don't disagree with you, really. I think it is kind of an impossible one to get around for a couple of reasons. One is that, like, first of all of the apes except for Caesar are basically still learning English. I think it's pretty heavily implied through the films that Caesar is not just the leader, but also the most intelligent, you know, having been exposed to the retrovirus that makes them smart from birth and not just from already being an adult. So he's learned a lot more. He's been exposed to speaking a lot more. But then aside from all of that, like, they mostly speak in sign language when they're just amongst themselves. Yeah. So not a lot of the other apes really have that much opportunity to practice English. So I also don't know how you get around. I don't disagree with you. I'm just saying, I also don't know how you get around. I think it's a storytelling choice, and I think it's going to either work for someone or not. And I don't know how I would change it. I think it's, yeah, I get what you're saying. I don't entirely disagree, but I also don't know how to change it.
So we struggle with that.
Yeah. I can't believe we haven't talked more about, now that I said that was where I wanted to end it. I think it sort of goes without saying, I can't believe we haven't talked about how incredible the special effects are. In particular, the creation of the apes. And personally, I think this film does a lot for, you know, advocating mocap as a category worthy of recognition at award shows, personally. Does anyone have any strong feelings about that? Richard, it sounds like you might.
Well, I was just going to say, I thought it was very noticeable, the step up in quality and technology from Rise of the Planet of the Apes to Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. I saw several segments that were a little wonky in Rise when it came to the CGI and the presentation of these characters in the scenes. That was much less problematic in the follow-up films. It seemed much more natural, and I didn't see any of the sort of, I don't know, mirror image or halos that the characters had that I saw in the first one. And so that I did appreciate that. And you're right about the motion capture performances, especially, like I said, with the main characters, you get a lot of that. And I thought that was pretty effective. So I would agree with you on that.
I would go so far as to say that I noticed pretty big difference from one film to the next all the way through. Because you're right, there's a huge step up in terms of like that sort of halo cutout effect from the first one to the second one. But then it's still present in a couple of scenes, especially when anyone, or especially, I hate to say it, especially Caesar, there's a number of scenes where it's like basically just a close-up of him speaking. And he looks divorced from the background. Like, he looks like he's been pasted in place in a couple of scenes. And then in the third film, I would say that's effectively entirely gone. Like, they just look real in the third film to me. And it is kind of amazing to watch that technology progress. Nicole, did you have any feelings on the effects, or did it affect the storytelling for you or your experience of the film?
It did, in the sense that I didn't think about it, which is something that some movies don't achieve quite as well as other movies. You mentioned them looking real in the third film. I would agree with that. I like it. It seems that with this franchise, it gets, as you guys have mentioned, I didn't notice the halos that Richard mentioned in Rise, but it makes me now want to watch it again, just to kind of the same way that I missed that gun in War. I want to watch Rise again just to check out like the different effects. But I appreciate that they did a good job with improving on the effects with each film that's released, since this usually happens in reverse with some franchise. So definitely, you know, kudos to the makers, you know, of the Planet of the Apes universe. I hope that they continue this with Kingdom. And so, because I never thought about the effects much, or at least when it came to characters, I think that's something to be said about how well they made the movie. If I'm not thinking about your effects, you're doing a good job.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing about special effects, right? The best version of them is invisible. Like, you don't know it's an effect. So that, I think they managed to pull it off in the third one, especially. I don't think Sean is back, but that is everything I sort of wanted to talk about. So I think there I'll pass it back to Richard to outro us.
All right, well, this has been our discussion of the Planet of the Apes franchise reboot section. We do have a fourth film coming up here in just a couple of weeks. We're going to take a brief break here before we come back for our exit question of the week to hear from a fellow LAM Podcasting Network show, and then we'll talk about another franchise possibility.
I was having serious problems in the bedroom, and in the car, and on the bus. But I couldn't help but think there had to be something out there for people suffering just like me.
Podcast dysfunction affects 6 out of 7 cinema geeks out there, but there is help. The Simplistic Reviews Podcast.
Symptoms of the Simplistic Reviews Podcast may include loss of sleep, loss of hair, longer erections, lost family get-together, bleeding of eyes, ears, and anus, divorce, hated by town folk, rash, the ability to drink alcohol and podcast at the same time, mansplaining, weight gain, weight loss, people with severe podcasting games, depression, happiness, growth of boobs and hair on chest, constant peeing, watery eyes, and 3 additional inches on your penis, and if you don't have a penis, you will now.
Thanks to the Simplistic Reviews Podcast, I'm no longer bored in the bedroom. Plus, I have a perpetual erection. Although I think I'm going blind.
The Simplistic Reviews Podcast. A small price to pay for entertainment.
Well, we lost one of our lambs. Hopefully our lost sheep will return to us. But until that happens, we're going to continue. It's time for the exit question of the week. And the exit question of the week was suggested by our guest host today. Matthew, you want to repeat it for everybody so that we know what it is we're talking about?
Absolutely. So the Planet of the Apes reboot trilogy is obviously a very successful reboot trilogy of a bygone franchise. And my question is, what other, and to be fair, there's a ton of them that have been going through this lately, but what franchise from the past and any era of the past you like, would you like to see be given the, the reboot, an overdue reboot? Or a re-reboot, or whatever you like. Whatever, what franchise would you like to see come back with a new series of films? And let's start with Nicole.
So I don't know if my pick will count. You could let me know if it does. If it doesn't, I do have a backup.
There's no bad choices as far as I'm concerned, but hit us with it.
Because it is actually a TV show that kept getting rebooted, and I want to see it on the big screen. So I would love to see the show 24, the series starring Kiefer Sutherland, made into a film. I think that it would do well as an action movie franchise, and I'd really like to see it adapted into a theatrical film series. It's already been rebooted multiple times in the form of a television series. And much like a lot of movie franchises, the reboots didn't, always live up to the quality of the main show. And they have several seasons of 24. So there's a lot of material to work with, but that is something that I would like to see as a franchise with a couple of other movies as a honorable mention.
I don't really like, I think that's actually a really interesting choice. My question would be, given that the whole hook of 24 is that it takes place in real time, like, the main show each season was 24 episodes because it takes place over 24 hours. So how would you adapt that? Would it be like 4 films at 6 movies each, or 6 hours each? Or like, what would be your thought about that?
I actually used to run an online 24 group where we would discuss the shows every week. And so I'm actually open to any type of iteration, including that, that 4-part, 6-hour, like franchise that you mentioned, Matt, as well as like a a multi-part, like, 24-hour movie. Like, they could do it the way that they do Seinfeld, or Law and Order, where there's, like, maybe, or like Dune, where there's, like, a part one and a part two.
Mm-hmm.
I think they could do it like that. Maybe a 12-hour movie, and then you see you watch the next one, and then they roll that into like a new storyline that takes place during another 12 hours.
So you're thinking about
a 12-hour movie sounds a little ambitious for most audiences.
not to watch, not to sit and watch, but to condense it, because you know they Fox was able to squeeze those 24 hours into an hour, so they could figure it out. Figure it out, folks.
Well, that seems to be the way to do it.
Someone out there.
That seems to be the way to do it, is you'd have a single 2-hour movie that does 24 hours, and you'd have to write the script so that the whole story takes place in a single day to justify the 24 film connection.
Yes. And then someone gets shot at the end, or something blows up, and then, you know, we see a new character, and then it rolls over into another 24 hours.
Right, and everything ends with everything's solved, or is it?
Yeah. Yes, because they had like 3 presidents, I think, like in the original show, the original series, there were like 3 different presidents, I think. And so that's enough material for a quick little franchise.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think it's a bad idea at all. Richard, how about you? Do you have anything that, any franchise you'd like to see come back in a big way?
Well, I've got 2 things that I was thinking of. And when we were talking about franchises, I went to a franchise that I really liked. In fact, I championed it 5 or 6 years ago to the Franchise Movie of the Month conversation that we had in April. And that's the Dirty Harry franchise. I don't expect Clint Eastwood to return to it, but it seems to me that we could get another Dirty Harry kind of character who is, you know, look, we're full of cops who are working outside of the system. We've had plenty of those things, but Harry was an interesting character because he was kind of a misanthrope in a city that's full of people that are, you know, identify in a different way. You know, they're much more connected and outgoing than he was. He's the outsider, not only in the police department, but in the city that he's working in. And I just like the idea that we have a cop who's sort of willing to, he's interested in justice and not necessarily the rules. I know that, like I said, we've had characters like this before. There are plenty of Schwarzenegger characters that are like that, but he still has to operate in the system, and I think that would be an interesting thing to do. I don't know that if you want to stick Scott Eastwood in them, but, you know, we need a younger actor to kind of start the process and keep it going, and I think that would be a lot of fun.
The sort of world that we live in now would have a lot of different things to say about a cop existing and working outside the system.
Oh, yeah.
In the 70s. There's a lot of real-world drama to mine there, I think.
Yeah, well, I think you could tell the whole movie through a YouTube scenario. We'd be getting that. The second idea that I had is probably a little controversial because this was supposed to be a thing, and it died because the first film in the process bombed at the box office and was critically lambasted. I don't object to the idea of a universal dark universe where we have the universal monsters as the main storylines in a series of films. Now, the Tom Cruise Mummy movie may have not been good, but that doesn't mean that the concept of a universe where these monsters are real and are dealing with them couldn't be something that worked. Like a lot of these things, I think everybody goes too grandiose. It's always the end of the world scenario. I don't think it needs to be, you know, if we don't stop the mummy, the world will capitulate to enslavement by here. I'm perfectly willing to, you know, have Frankenstein's monster creating mayhem in a city, and we have to figure that one out. Or that the Invisible Man has gone mad and is wreaking havoc in our economic system or our tourist trade or something along those lines, and we have to address those issues. It doesn't have to be the world will turn dark or the universe will end because of the monster. And we could have these characters be interesting. Look, there are a lot of these movies that have been done well. The Invisible Man story with Elizabeth Moss, for instance, I thought would have fit well into this concept of the dark universe. And having characters cross over, not necessarily a bad thing. I don't know that Russell Crowe as Dr. Jekyll has to be involved in the series, but I do like the idea that maybe, we would get a little bit of crossover. Maybe Dr. Frankenstein would be involved in helping investigate, vampires and Dracula or something like that. I thought it was an interesting idea to have that dark universe, and because the one movie blew up on them, it killed that idea, and I thought that was a little unfortunate.
Maybe this is controversial, maybe it's not, but I actually completely agree with you. I thought that was a super interesting idea. I think they got let down. I think they sort of signed their own death warrant in that they were very clearly focused on trying to build a universe before they were trying to tell good stories.
Yeah.
And that sort of imploded the whole idea. Like, I think they approached it wrong, but I would love to be in the timeline where we're just getting a monster movie every year or so. I would love that personally. And also, like, the Tom Cruise Mummy movie is, just to be clear, not very good. But it's an interesting film to watch because it's actually pretty rare you can watch an outright Tom Cruise misfire. And I think that's kind of fascinating in and of itself. I also have two franchises I was thinking about when I asked this question. But I'm going to focus on one, and it's one that is, it's actually a long-standing franchise. It was very famously made into a series of films in the 30s. And then a very famous TV show in the 60s, and then a not great movie in the 90s, but I would love to see a reboot of The Saint. Which, for those of you who don't know, listening at home, the Saint is a character called Simon Templar, who is a con man and a thief and a Robin Hood type figure, who is a very suave British gentleman who basically goes to places and rights wrongs and leaves a calling card that's a stick figure with a halo and says a lot of clever things. It's basically James Bond if he wasn't government sanctioned, basically. And I would love to see that. If you haven't seen it before, there's the TV series from the 60s starred Roger Moore, who went on to be James Bond. And the series of films from the 30s are basically all really fun. And I would love to see that sort of fun energy. Like, basically, James, if you can think of James Bond, but like silly and fun, that's what I'm pitching here. And I would love to see that come back. That was what I was thinking of when I asked the question initially.
That's an interesting idea. I vaguely remember the series. Look, The Saint was a TV series when I was alive. But I vaguely remember because I didn't watch it closely. But I do remember that it was fun. And Roger Moore, like you said, basically carried the idea of silly and fun into the Bond universe. So I didn't think that's an unreasonable way of visualizing this character. I have seen maybe one of the George Sanders Saint movies from the 30s and 40s. I know TCM was running them on Saturdays for a long time. I don't know if they're still doing that, but that might be a big, good place to catch up with them and see how they hold up as a concept. But it seems fun. And the Val Kilmer thing was okay.
Not terrible. This is not great, Like, it wasn't enough to start a franchise, even though they'd like, and to be fair, we didn't start franchises in the 90s like we do today. I like the idea of, like, a handsome rogue who's a master of disguise who can, drop into a scene and say something funny and get away with whatever he needs to get away with. And there's lots of other franchises that are of a similar sort of ilk, but I've always liked that version. The I don't know if they're still there, but at least half a dozen of the, like, nine movies from the 30s, eight or nine, I think it's eight movies from the 30s, were available also on the Criterion Channel, if you get that, if you subscribe to that at one point. So they're around, and they're fun in a very 1930s sort of way, and I've always liked them. But yeah, that was my choice.
Well, good deal. Good deal. Well, I want to thank everybody for joining the show today, give you a chance to plug things that you would like people to turn their eyes and ears to. Nicole, do you have something that you want people to be paying attention to in the next few weeks?
Only the Lambcast YouTube channel.
Have you been enjoying that, by the way?
I have. I also wanted to just mention it for those who listen to the Lambcast and might want some visuals. If you want some visuals to accompany our lovely voices, I recommend subscribing to the Lambcast. Richard does a great job putting these videos together. I am a subscriber myself. And so if you like movies, that's where you can find us.
All right. Well, I appreciate the plug for the Lambcast. And again, it's MadLab Post. If you guys want to follow Nicole, that's where to find her. And I'll put her link in the show notes so everybody can do that. Matthew, how about you? You got something going on?
So I host the Awesome Friday podcast, which is a weekly podcast where we review two films. And as soon as we hang up on this, I'm picking up on that. We're going to be talking about two new movies, Rebel Moon and another one that has my train of thought has left at the station, apparently. But also, I write freelance and appear in podcasts on a fairly regular basis. The easiest way to catch up with all of that is to hit up my personal portfolio website, which is stretched.ca. I post links to everything that I do there. And I reviewed a number of things over the past couple of weeks. I actually have a bunch of writing coming up in the next week or so. So if you want to read about a great Canadian film called The King Tide, or the new season of Doctor Who, or a few other things, the new Apple TV series as well should be, my review of Fat Dark Matter should be going up soon. So there'll be a lot of writing in the next week or two to keep up on.
We'll make sure to put those connections in the notes so that people can find all of that content. We lost Sean during the show, but I'll make sure that I find whatever contacts he has and put them in the show notes. I want to thank him for joining the show. I'm sorry that we had some technical difficulty that we weren't able to resolve, but I want to thank everybody for joining the show this week. I'm a little behind on the YouTube version of the Lambcast. I've got one show that's halfway done. I've been busy. I've been on the road. So I'm going to catch up, folks. You'll get a new one. This will go up soon, and the video version of it will probably take a couple more days than I usually do. But thanks, everybody, for joining us. And remember, beware the beast man, for he's the devil's pawn. And sometimes I feel like that's exactly what's going on. I've been taken by the devil's pawn. Have a good week, everybody.
You've been listening to the Lambcast. If you have an idea for a show or would like to join us on the Lambcast, contact us at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Find us on Facebook, just search for Lambcast, or on X, formerly Twitter, at Lambcast. And you can find us on YouTube as well. The Lamb site can be found at largeassmovieblogs.com. We'd also love it if you would leave a review on iTunes.